97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
This is a day when all Americans from every walk of life unite in our resolve for justice and peace. America has stood down enemies before, and we will do so this time. None of us will ever forget this day, yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world. Thank you. Good night, and God bless America.
George W. Bush from 9/11, and obviously as we start the roundtable this afternoon, we're going to share some memories, somber as they might be. Former State Senator Jeff Smith is with us this afternoon. Hello, Jeff. How are you? As you're getting the headphones on, getting ready to go, good to see you this afternoon.
Good to see you too, Mark.
Thanks for coming in. Former State Senator John Lamping also here this afternoon. Hello, John.
Hey, Mark. Always great to be here.
We were starting to share some stories, Jeff, before you even got here, and I stopped John because I wanted to do it on the air. My story from 9/11 is very simple. I was in Milwaukee. I was watching Blue's Clues with my kids. Aiden was a year and a half. Evan was about 4 years old. My sister called me. I always liked that it was on the landline. I mentioned that yesterday, too. I remember answering the landline. And I was watching on a regular basis. I would watch the Today Show back then. And she said, "Are you watching the Today Show?" And I said, "No." She said, "Turn it on." And about 5 minutes after I turned it on, I saw the second plane go in. Now, what I've said here the last couple of days is, I don't know why it is, but I have spent more time this week looking at memories of 9/11, being affected by those memories of 9/11, more so than any other anniversary. And I don't know why that is, John. I don't know if it's because it's the 25th or if I just was in a mood and, you know, I just get captivated by some of this stuff. And some of it's just heartbreakingly sad. I mean, just unreal. I was telling you, I was watching this one documentary that I'd never seen that's on YouTube. And this was something where you had a filmmaker that was shooting a firehouse in New York City, had no idea that something of this magnitude would happen. He's just doing a video and a documentary on this firehouse. And when they start to get in there, you know, when they don't really know what's happened, they know the plane has hit the tower, they know there's jet fuel that's pouring down the elevator shafts, but they start hearing these thumping noises. And the thumping noises were the jumpers. Those were the people that, you know, they felt like they were going to burn to death and it would be better off if they jumped out of the towers. And it was just horrific. So you started to share some memories. Where were you when this all happened 25 years ago?
Well, I was here back in St. Louis, but I had spent most of the 90s. I was a bond trader on Wall Street, and Cantor Fitzgerald was the bond brokerage shop that sits atop the World Trade Center. And the way my job was is I would have a headphone on where I would have an open line into Cantor Fitzgerald for 8 hours a day. Very wonderful close friend of mine, Steve Haggis, who had been a 7-foot-tall guy, who's a basketball player at Fairfield in Connecticut. He was my broker. He was in my left ear the entire time I was on Wall Street. And so obviously we knew each other really personally quite well. He and I were both there in 93. The first bombing occurred.
That's crazy,
too. Which is crazy.
And like, you literally felt that one,
oh,
right?
We felt it. We heard it. I worked right across the street from the Trade Center. Steve was amazing, amazing born-again Christian guy. He actually carried someone down like 70 flights of stairs on the 93 bombing. And then he would share with me, he was in the process of going to get his MBA. He was convinced that they were going to bomb the Trade Center again.
Really?
And he took out a tremendous amount of life insurance specific to the time he was going to be working. It was amazing. And then so when it happened, you know, I was immediately in touch with friends that worked at my old firm or across the street, what was going on with them. To the extent I could talk to them, it was hard to get through. Mm-hmm. But I knew, so I knew Steve quite well. And I knew a dozen guys in that trading floor that I had known for years, and they all passed away.
Is it your assumption that with your friend in particular, he was killed relatively quickly? Was there communication from him at all to anybody?
There was no communication from them, but Steve was kind of guy, he was such a man of God that, you know, I felt like he was meant to be there. You know,
Jeff, one of the things when I've listened to some of the phone calls that people have made, like from Flight 93 or even at the top of the tower, they're remarkably calm. And I don't know if that's because of a realization or because of concern about panicking their loved ones, but that's really resonated with me this week. Now, you lived in New York City at one point, but that was well after 9/11, right?
At 2 points. I lived okay. there right before 9/11.
You did? Okay, I didn't know that.
I did. At the end, I worked for Bill Bradley, the former U.S. Senator from New Jersey, and his headquarters was just outside New York City when he ran for president. And I first worked in Iowa and then worked out of the national headquarters. And so I had just recently moved back from New York City when 9/11 happened, then subsequently moved back to New York years later. The morning that it happened, I was teaching a political science course at Wash U. I think the class started at 8:30. And so I saw the first plane from my apartment, but just figured that it was a plane that flew off track.
Yeah, at first we thought it was just an accident, right?
Yeah. And then I was in front of, 30 undergraduates when my phone started, ringing, explaining, that the second plane had hit the towers. And
that was the realization at that point. Everybody knew it.
At that moment, since my phone kept ringing, at like the fourth or fifth time, I just said, excuse me, let me just make sure, and there's not some kind of emergency. And then I picked up the phone. Then I turned on the television in front of the class, and we all sat and processed it together as a class.
There was so much to process in such a short time because, I think we all remember being shocked and stunned at seeing big holes inside the World Trade Centers. But then when they collapsed and that happened, that I think set us into a whole new particular area of not only grief and tragedy, but that was just crazy to see that. And I've seen so many videos of the dust that's rising up, the people that, let's face it, there were people that were just hanging out not too far from the towers when the first plane went in, not having any clue that it would affect them. They were seemingly a couple of blocks away, but when something that large collapses on itself, it was just amazing. The other thing that really makes me sad is, and I read a column from someone yesterday whose father passed away in 9/11, and I believe that never got to meet the father, if I'm not mistaken on this one. And, they were kind of longing for the reaction that the country had. We were all together, right? There wasn't the division. Now, we had division in the 2000 election, obviously. That was tough. It goes down to hanging chads. And, the beginning of the 2000s, I think, were pretty good economically, if I have to remember correctly. But obviously, when this happens, everybody comes together, is on the same page. I'll never forget, because I've talked about this week. Friday, for me, of that week, it was a Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken, right? Cardinals were in Milwaukee, where I was. Mm-hmm. But Friday was the night of the candlelight vigil. And I remember driving through neighborhoods in suburban Milwaukee because I was going to a charity event, which we almost called off, but we figured that people needed to take a breath a little bit. But it was so inspiring to see all these homes. I was passing home after home after home who had candles to memorialize the victims of 9/11. And that, you almost, in a very sad way, Jeff, wonder if the country would ever come together like that again, right?
Yeah, I think the president's approval ratings were 90%,
In the aftermath of that, right away, yeah.
In the aftermath of that. And that just feels unheard of in this day and age when no president, no matter how good things are, seem to get above the high 50s, because you kind of have your, 40 to 45% who kind of always are with you, usually, always are with one party. If you're very popular, the times are good, you have peace abroad, you might get an extra 10% of independents, maybe a few of the other side's voters, but it's really been a long time. I can't remember, other than Bush in the wake of 9/11, I don't remember a time since I've been paying attention to politics in the early 1990s, except right after Clinton was impeached. Do you remember he shot up into the mid-60s?
Did he really?
He shot up into the mid-60s right after his impeachment as a kind of reaction against what a lot of independent voters perceived to be overreach. But there really hasn't been another president since then. Obama was popular at first, and then, just kind of gutted it out to get through his reelect. We have not seen the kind of unity that existed in the wake of 9/11 around any national politician, anything approaching that for 25 years.
You know, John, one of the things, and you mentioned 93. Look, this should we didn't do a very good job in the late 90s. There's a great Netflix documentary which kind of ties a lot of things together. There are a couple of former CIA folks in there, maybe it's FBI, that tell the story, you know, and there were warning signs that led up to 9/11. Mm-hmm. Your friend was even concerned about that. So there were so many national security failures. I think we were all stunned at the time that there was not communication that was very common between local law enforcement and the feds. So that was fixed. I believe personally, you guys can, you know, share your opinions on this, that we're really good at overreacting in this country. So what we did then is we created one of the biggest behemoth, you know, bureaucracies that's ever been created in the Department of Homeland Security. And I'm not convinced that that's made us a whole lot safer overall. Anyway, we're finally to the point 25 years later where we can wear our shoes when we're going onto the airplane, not at every airport, but we're starting to get that. But thoughts on, you know, there were warning signs, obviously.
Well, yeah, I mean, the 90s were a very, very unique time. There was the tremendous prosperity. You had this big cohort of people. The boomers were in their prime. The economy was booming. Technology was brand new. The government actually did not have a deficit. They actually started retiring outstanding debt in the early 2000s. And I think anyone could have been president when that happened in terms of the country coming together. It was the ultimate populist response. You know, I say very often that the vast majority of people don't care about politics at all. But it was so blatantly obvious that the country had been wronged and that we were going to come together. That day changed everything. You know, it changed the country. That was like an end of an era. Like I said, we were balancing budgets and we were buying back our debt. We created these huge monstrosities. The government grew dramatically just on the response, things like TSA. And then, to go to war the way we went to war and to leave us at war for 15 years, suddenly you saw all of those balanced budgets become in deficit, and now one of the greatest crises faced in the country. And the reason we're so very weak today is our fiscal stature where we find ourselves. So that was, historians will write about that day as at the end of an era and the beginning of the next one. And I think they'll look back fondly on the era that ended and not so fondly on the one that began.
Jeff Smith, your thoughts on the way that he just kind of broke that down? Be curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of the polarization began during the Clinton years. You know, Newt Gingrich was kind of the culmination in Congress of a newly aggressive posture towards the other party. And I think he was a seminal figure in American political life in changing the tone of American politics. But I think some of that polarization happened a little bit earlier. I do agree 100% with what John said about deficit spending. We had finally emerged after nearly three decades of running deficits. The last couple of years of the Clinton administration, combination of a Republican House and finally a Democrat with real fiscal discipline were in office, cutting bipartisan deals to produce surpluses of hundreds of billions of dollars in his last couple of years. And that would have taken us, we were actually going to be on track to eliminate the national debt.
Right.
We had at the end of that time of his administration, we had about $5 trillion. We've got eight times that now. So, you know, it took us 25 years as a country to generate $5 trillion of debt. And then we've generated another $35 trillion, eight times that, in just the 25
years. It's outrageous.
Since.
And nobody seems to care about it in either party at this
point.
Well,
John and I both care.
Well, I care.
Yeah.
Politically, it's past us now. You know, like it's not even discussed. Both parties are guilty.
No, you're right. It's not even discussed.
Because both parties are guilty of having it ended up where it ended up. The Tea Party movement lasted all of about 3 or 4 years. That was the last time at a national level an attempt was made to have some kind of discussion around reining in the size of government, cutting spending, focusing on the deficit. It's not even a topic of conversation. I think neither party governs with any eye towards the fiscal discipline. And so now we are where we are.
Have you guys, I've already spent my $5,000 that Trump's sending me. What about you guys?
I'm waiting to package it with my Doge dividend check.
And with the money that I'm going to owe you when Steve Hilton doesn't win the California general election, because I think we have a wager on that. Hang tight. It's a Reardon Roundtable on 9/11. John Lamping and Jeff Smith. All right, so Reardon Roundtable on a Friday afternoon. Former State Senators Jeff Smith and John Lamping in the studio with me. I'll start with you, Jeff. We'll get this off your chest, the Missouri chaos with the elections. I mean, this is a big mess. And, you know, what I said last week after the Missouri Supreme Court ruled, and I know you can't take the politics out of this, but just for a moment, take the politics out of it. Because if I'm someone who was in St. Charles County or someone on the other side of the state, and I voted in the primary and I voted for a particular congressional candidate that I expected would be on the ballot in November, and now that person might be on a different ballot in a different district, how is that not disenfranchising the voters? Now, you can talk about who's to blame in all this and all that, and that's fair enough, but isn't that the very definition of disenfranchising voters?
Well, I mean, I think it's really hard to talk about it without putting it in the context of, you know, the Secretary of State had a decision to make when over 300,000 petition signatures were presented to him in December of last year, and he sat on them for like 8 months instead of making a decision. And that put voters in an untenable position, the position that you described, where you'd voted for one set of people in parts of the state in a primary, and now we'll have a different nominee maybe than the one you voted for in the general. But it's because, you know, the Secretary of State decided, and encouraged by many other members of his party, decided, you know what, for without any legal justification, I'm going to ignore these 300,000 signatures to put the new map on the ballot as part of a veto referendum to give voters a chance to weigh in on it before it becomes law, which was the proper way of doing it. Because he declined to do it that way and just said, oh, it's too late to do it now because I'm not making a decision for 8 months. And now we already have run the primary with the current people. Now, you know, two wrongs make a right, you know, because we did it that way for the primary. Now we have to do it the same way for the general. And the Missouri Supreme Court unanimously, 7-0, 5 Republican appointees and the United States Supreme Court all said, no, two wrongs don't make a right. Just because you did it that way in the primary doesn't mean you have to do it that way during the general because you didn't do it properly in the first place.
It's difficult for me to argue against my friend Jeff Smith there, John Lamping. What would you say about the scenario?
Well, I wouldn't argue with him. I would suggest that this, the Republican Party is paying the price for not having any kind of ideological leadership amongst its leaders. That, for instance, the opportunity was very straightforward back when they were doing redistricting, that they could have done a 7-1 map. The conservative wing of the state Senate pushed for a 7-1 map. Our current governor, Keogh, lieutenant governor at the time, poo-pooed it. They were not for it. We ended up with a 6-2 map. But I think it goes further than that. Our state is slowly but surely being governed. Laws are being made. Constitutions are being amended by the citizen-led initiative petition process. The decision of the Secretary of State to delay the way he delayed, with the inevitable being the inevitable. I think that if you had gamed this out, this is what was going to happen. They missed the opportunity once again to explain to people. Now we've got Amendment 6 and we've got Proposition A. Proposition A is kind of easy. If you want a 6-2 map, Proposition A is your fix. Amendment 6 is very, very dangerous now. Like, I'm of the camp that we shouldn't be governing ourselves by citizen-led initiative petition with a threshold being a simple 50% for both legislation, which propositions are for, and for constitutional changes. Amendment 6 will strengthen the what it means to have an initiative petition turned into law, turned into an amendment, such that this state, which has been governed at the big ideological level by initiative petition, citizen-led, is going to be even more so. And this is how states like Colorado went from being deep red to purple to deep blue. If you look at how much money gets mobilized to come into a state like ours.
I can't argue with you on this stuff either. And I understand that. And I get that that's why they've been trying to do something with this initiative petition process, but they've failed at every turn. The voters were supposed to decide this, and obviously they rejected it as well. So at this point, there's no fix for this, is there?
No. And my point is to say is that Republicans in charge have not been ideological, and they have not taken the time and the energy to explain to the citizens of Missouri how important to fix this.
Nobody's going to go into that voting booth and know what the hell Amendment 6 even is, right?
Well, I think the other side's going to do a pretty good job of explaining to people how they want that outcome to be.
So that'll be a no.
I think that the left. Look, hats off to the left. They played this brilliantly. That they know what they have in Missouri. They have this real simple initiative petition process.
It's not real simple. It's hard to get 300,000 signatures.
No, it's not. No, it is. Jeff, you spend enough money. It's not hard at all. Come on. Give me a break.
I don't think that's that hard.
Not that hard. No, it's hard to raise the money.
A lot more people have tried and failed over the last two decades than have succeeded in getting on the ballot.
That's because most people that try don't have tens of millions of dollars, Jeff. Tens of millions of dollars get you on the ballot. You know that, and I know that.
It did not get David Humphreys on the ballot when he tried to change the nonpartisan court plan multiple times 15 years
because
ago.
Because the money
again. So there's multiple counterexamples.
Well, 15 years ago, I think the money has changed dramatically in that. Well, but, John, how can you not look? If you're starting, because I'm a balls and strikes guy, you're starting to look at what's going on with the governor of the legislature 2 years into Governor Kehoe's terms. There's not a lot of W's in that column. There's a lot of L's in that column right there, right?
So I changed my Twitter handle. You don't know what it is. And it's the narrow gate 26, okay?
And I did notice that, and I wasn't sure why you did that.
Well, for different reasons. Okay. But anyway, Kehoe's upside down in polling. He's unfavorable. His unfavorables are higher than his favorables. Kehoe's had a miserable first 2 years in office. The hard stuff hasn't even started yet, meaning that they got a budget they have to balance that they're not going to be able to balance. And my tweet to you was, is Jason Kander warming up in the bullpen? Because the opportunity is here now, if not for the fact the National Party and the left is, turned socialist and everything. But the right candidate in Missouri for any office can do really well, not just in 2026. I think things are bad now for the Republican Party in 26. But if I were on Jeff's team and I had the capacity to find the right set of candidates going into 2028, I think they could be very successful because I don't see a course change because the guys that run our party, they don't have strong feelings. Their strong feelings come from their donors, and the public has kind of caught on to the fact that state government is really not there for them. State government is there for the benefit of these donors, and Republicans are just the instruments by which the donors get what they want.
Jeff Smith, do you see in the maps, if we're going to the 22 maps, are there risks out there for any of the incumbents, and Wagner in particular, in the 2nd District?
Yeah, so as part of the redistricting, it did two things. Principally, it opened up a huge opportunity for Republicans to take Emanuel Cleaver's district in Kansas City, which is the district that everybody talks about, because that would flip from being overwhelmingly Democratic to overwhelmingly Republican. The less known consequence of the new map is that the new map that just got rejected is that it would have pushed Ann Wagner further west. Okay,
and Franklin County.
And the further you go west into Franklin County, better the district is for Republicans.
Right.
The more you're in these inner ring suburbs, the better it is for Democrats. It reverts back to the map that's been getting harder and harder for Republicans every cycle, really, for the last 20 years, which took a district that used to be a rock-ribbed Republican district and turned it into a district that, in the 2020 presidential election was the closest district between Biden and Trump, I believe in the whole country. I think it was decided by 115 votes. So we're going, so then when that was redrawn, they redrew it to help Ann Wagner and push it out a little bit west. But then the march of Democrats moving west made it
affected that, right?
Yeah, affected that. So then they had to try to make it better again in 2025.
So, John, is there risk for Ann Wagner in this election?
Not in this election, but in 2028 there is.
Okay. Let's take a break. We're coming back with more. All right, so Reardon Roundtable on 9/11. Some more memories coming a little later in the show. One of the things, and I didn't watch this last night, I recorded it. They had a documentary. My panel is John Lamping and Jeff Smith. Let me welcome them back. I don't know if you guys saw this or the promo, but they were doing a special documentary on MLB Network last night because, baseball played a very important role in the recovery after 9/11. I mentioned, the Cardinals were in Milwaukee at the time. That's where I was living. But, the game had to return. I don't remember how many games were canceled overall, but it did play. And, Jack Buck's role here with his poem, a very important role in the nation's healing. And that was on last night on MLB Network. We're going to take some memories back here in the 5 o'clock hour as we get closer to the end of the show as well. We'll lighten things up for the next hour, and Sue will have Sue's news. We'll get Cusimano on the Mizzou game tonight, of which I am very nervous, and Paul Hall on entertainment. John Lamping, was it a smart idea and was there benefit to Republicans for having a midterm convention in Dallas, Texas the last couple of nights? Brilliantly juxtaposed against two of the first NFL games. Who the idiot was that didn't look at the calendar for that one, I think should probably lose their job. But was this something that benefited Trump and the Republicans?
I think that it was a neutral to the public. Like, the public is not really involved in politics. I don't think ratings are very high. I don't think it was like a traditional, I mean, even non-political people will tune in to the convention during the presidential cycle. But for people that are the boots on the ground, the people that have to go back now, because now we're 53 days out from the election, that have to go back and actually work the precincts and do all that kind of stuff, to the extent that they enjoy those kind of things, it's not my kind of thing. But I think that there has to be, you know, a positive to them. But that's a very small circle of people. It's not voters. It's just people that work in the party.
So you were very early in on Trump in 2016. And, you know, John and I have known each other for a long time. And you kept telling me, and I wasn't listening. But when it comes to, so you have good insight on this. You both do. You guys are, you know, on my A-list for the roundtable panelists. But if you had to, you know, click a box here, if I give you several options for the midterms, ass whooping, complete ass whooping, total annihilation, or Republicans do better than expected.
Okay, well, here's what I'm going to say. Right now, the expectation is really bad.
Yeah,
really
I know.
Bad.
I know okay? It is.
And this is kind of typical. If you look at all these cycles where, especially when Trump's involved, about 2 months out, he peaks at like, this is going to be horrible, right? And the Democrats, and I think there's a lot of, I mean, you know, we know this, and there's a lot of polling that goes into fundraising. I think that it'll be better than it feels today. I think they will lose the House, and I think it'll be really close in the Senate. And I attribute it to just one thing, and that's the decision that was made the last day of February to enter into this war. And if you look at, you know, we're what, 9 months from that time, not 9 months, 7 months from that time, gas is at least a dollar higher. Interest rates, this is interesting because that's a big issue in Wall Street. Interest rates are one full percentage point higher. The deficit's wider. We have to finance our deficits, so interest rates play a big role there. And I think that he lost a big part of his base. His base are ordinary working class people that are having a hard time with inflation, and going to fight a war in Iran does not help in that regard. And so the energy that was behind Trump all this time around is not going to be the same.
Well, look, you and I have been on the same page when it comes to the war from the very beginning. I think it's a disaster, and I don't understand it. He keeps saying over and over again, we can't allow, you know, Iran to have nuclear weapons. Everyone agrees with that, right? That's why there was not a lot of opposition, even from the left last year, when we bombed the living daylights out of them with the B-2s. But this has been different. And there's no end game in sight. I mean, yesterday he was talking about how the war's going to end after the election. I'm not sure how magically that's going to happen, but this is the exact opposite. And I'm really shocked. I really am shocked at how many people continue to defend that and the economics of this, saying, well, you know, gas prices were higher a little bit during Biden. I don't care. And I don't think the people that are spending 70 or 80 bucks filling up their tanks care right now either. They care about what's happening in the moment. You got diesel prices, which, by the way, are influenced by the war maybe in Ukraine more than the Middle East. But those are sky high right now. And that's going to affect everything, prices, you know, because trucks are taking all these products to different stores. So, Jeff, I'll let you kind of unfortunately agree with me and John on some of this. But I think the war has been an utter disaster. I don't see a way out of it. This was a guy that campaigned against forever wars and keeping gas prices low. Neither have happened.
Yes, let me take it in from two separate directions. Briefly, you asked about the midterm convention, and I think it was a debacle. I mean, the audience was basically the same audience that you'd have on a typical night for Hannity. So there weren't a lot of like swing voters or anything turning in. He was just speaking to the base.
No, we were all watching the NFL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Secondly, you know, he's at like 33% or something nationally, right? And so he's out there making it about him. And if you look back from 2016 on, the elections where it's been about Trump have not gone very well for him. He was able to make 2016 about Hillary, who was even less popular than him. He was able to make 2020 about, he was able to make 2024 about Kamala, who was even.
Well, you guys gave us a gift there. I mean, come on. There were a lot of gifts, and we appreciate it.
We gave you gifts in those races. In 2018, the midterm, the light was focused on him, and you guys got destroyed. 2020, Biden mostly just kind of stayed out of the picture and let it be about Trump. And that didn't go well for Trump. 2022, if you remember this, he came back a couple weeks before the midterm and tried to make it about him campaigning. That was a disaster for you guys. And now, again, he's saying, I am on the ballot. And that's the worst thing he could be doing for himself right now, because the next 2 years are going to be all about congressional investigations of the corruption in his administration.
See, what's frustrating for me, John, is that I don't want to forget, and I don't think the audience should forget, there's so many good things that he did that I'm glad he did. And first and foremost, the big, beautiful bill, whatever the hell they want to call it, with the tax, you know, everyone's taxes would have gone up. That's something the Democrats like to conveniently forget. So there have been a lot of things. Now, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more effort. We got excited when it came to DOGE, right? And that kind of vanished. So there have been accomplishments by this administration that I think that the American people should be happy about. But he just doesn't seem to be aware of the damage being inflicted politically by the war, because he keeps saying the same things over and over again, and there aren't any different results. Now, this whole $5,000, you know, I joked about at the beginning, that's just dumb. No one's ever going to get $5,000 checks. He's made promises like that before. Why would you do that? And by the way, they've also criticized Democrats for bribing voters. Now, I get that he says it's because of the dividends from the tariffs, but someone's going to have to be a little bit more clear on the math here and show us the math, right?
So he got talked into the war, and from the, I mean, we were on the air like the Friday.
By whom, though? Who? By
By the people that like to go to war.
Okay, because everyone in the room, when they were talking about this, no one thought it was good. Marco Rubio didn't think it was a good idea. J.D. Vance didn't think it was a good idea. Nobody did.
But there's a huge universe of people in D.C. that there's a war machine. They want to go to war. The reason the wars are endless because they always have the next thing we need to do. Yes, he takes counsel from Netanyahu for sure. But he made a really bad decision, and I thought from the very beginning, I mean, I saw it as a horrible political decision, and I think he recognized it as such. I think the one thing that Trump is good at is kind of reading the political room to a certain degree, and he's been looking, if you go back and listen to every time he's had an opportunity from the very beginning, oh, this will be 2 to 4 weeks, this will be 4 weeks, this will be 6 weeks, it's like he knows he needs to get the hell out, and the issue I have from the very beginning is he's not getting out.
No.
Okay, he's not getting out, it's a quagmire. I mean, Bush left with, 33 looked high to Bush when he left. After his response by going into to Iraq, and from the what Trump is trying to do, what the administration is trying to do, is there's some huge changes. The reindustrialization of the country is something that takes a good 8 to 10 to 12 years to do that, and it requires you to have political power. And my concern back in February when we went to war was this will cost you political power. That concept, that idea will not get implemented if you're not in power. And from the minute they went to war, I knew that the probability of them staying in power was reduced. And I think, you know, he's still going to be president, and he'll probably have one of the two chambers. But it's made it that much harder for a Republican to win the presidency. It's already been leaked out. Rubio doesn't want to run. And I think that decision, you'll go back and you'll say, decision to go to war in February, whoever you decided, you know, to listen to that day, it cost this entire movement.
Look,
and it's a problem.
Even on the gas prices front, I even took callers on this early in the summer. People were sticking by Trump, and people were telling me gas prices are going to go down. It's going to, you know, they're going to plummet right by the end of the summer. I said, no, they weren't. And they're not going to. And they're not going to after November. Trump predicted yesterday, right after the election. No, we're stuck with this for a while. I mean, maybe they go down a little bit more next year. But people need to realize this. There's no magic reduction in the gas prices coming. Not at all.
A recession.
There is. Now we're talking recession. Exactly. So that's the next
down.
Part of the conversation.
Right. And
so that doesn't sit well with me either.
And as John knows, as well as anybody you have on here, given his experience in the markets, you cannot tell the markets to do something.
No. Having markets going to do what they
having
do.
Having Scott Bessent go out there and say, we're doing this because we're going to bring down interest rates. The market
doesn't matter.
Always knows better.
They do. I asked Rex Ziegfeld that one time recently. I said, hey, what's the market? He goes, I don't know. The market's going to do what the market does. And that's right. What happens, right? We're coming back. One more segment. All right. It's a Friday afternoon. It's a Reardon Roundtable. Ethan's just messing around with my camera here because apparently it was not. Did I mess it up? Apparently he thinks that I did, right? Former state senators Jeff Smith and John Lamping on the panel this afternoon. And, you know, we started with 9/11. Let me kind of wrap things up this way as well as we kind of take everyone into the weekend, because it is a day that people should kind of, you know, take a little time and remember. It's also my wife's birthday, by the way, which for several years she didn't admit it was on 9/11. But, you know, I don't know if I heard this figure, John, the other day that, like, I think this is a little hard to believe, but there's a good portion of the country that was not alive. They said the other day on Fox, like, a third of the country. That seems way extreme when it comes to the math. But, you know, I have two children who are in their 20s. One's almost 30, who was too young to remember this, right? My other son was about a year and a half at the time. There are a lot of people that just don't have the recognition, and I don't know if they're going to take the time to watch a documentary or to see some of the video. They're not going to be affected the way we were, because we were there and we experienced that day, that week, that month, those years, unfortunately. So I don't know what the the lasting, the long-term effect will this be on the country. I am a little surprised, you know, we didn't talk about this earlier. I'm surprised we have never been hit hard again, as hard as that. I think a lot of us expected that. I thought maybe a mall or a baseball game, right, or a football game. So to our credit, you know, when it comes to breaking up terrorist plots, we've heard a lot of that over the last few years in particular. Maybe that's a good thing, because I hope we're safer than we were 25 years ago.
I think the bad guys know that they're better off when we're not unified. So when we came together at 90% after 9/11, that doesn't work for the bad guys. I think what's working for the bad guys is what's happening now.
Yeah.
The country's so divided on things, and we've got this, you know, unfettered illegal immigration, and that's a much better way to take over the United States is the way it's being taken over right now, which is slowly, methodically over a long period of time. And so maybe that's one of the reasons why we haven't had the terrorist attacks.
And just in that vein, tangentially related, you can see in some of the online conversation about things like data centers or Flock, it's been uncovered that there's like Chinese bot farms that are like trying to sow dissent on these issues within America. And yeah. So, you know, we need to keep our political arguments, you know, focused on, hey, here's what policy would be good for the country, and not let the more emotional a lot of this stuff gets. I think the more dangerous it becomes for our country because we see one another as our enemy, which is very dangerous.
Look, I agree with you. And look, I think what we need to have moving forward, data centers is a great example. We need to have educated conversations about data centers. This should not be a partisan issue. First and foremost, this is a national security issue, okay? And we are going to need this to move forward. But all we have now is politicians like Mike Rogers in Michigan, who, because some voters are against data centers, caves. And Mike Rogers knows how important, you know, he was the chair of the National Intelligence, committee when he was in the House.
Can I say something you won't hear me say much on this show? I think Trump had it right on data centers. That was one of the first things I've heard him say in the last couple months that I was like, you know, he made a good argument, and that was common sense. And I wish all politicians could get their messaging that succinct in 30 seconds and say, hey, look, we got to put some parameters in place to make sure surrounding communities don't pay a ton more for the electricity.
We need them.
This is an important thing, and we can't fall behind the rest of the
world. No, he gets
Let's
it.
Let's put parameters around these things so that it's workable.
The problem is that people don't trust government. It's at an all-time low, and rightly so.
I can't disagree with that.
That's true, too.
What happened after 9/11 was not something that, you know, lends you to trust the government. What happened in the financial crisis, bailouts, that people don't trust government. And then when COVID happened, what the government did to people during those 3 or 4 years, and even up till now, and then to the extent they're covering up and lying about it, and, you know, this whole thing of, like, the vaccine was you know, what did Biden say, that you if you did it, get it, you can't take it, you can't get it. If you take the vaccine, you can't get the disease and you can't pass it. I mean, and now you come along and you have got the guys that are creating AI saying, hey, this is probably going to end the world, could end the world, it could be a biological warfare, it could be that all your jobs are gone, but just trust us, government's here to regulate it.
By the way, I was at the CVS in Target at Fenton, Gravois Bluffs a couple of days ago getting a prescription, and there was a woman in front of me, and they always ask you, like, one of the standard questions now probably at Walgreens too, is you want to get your vaccination, you want to get a flu shot, a COVID shot, and the woman in front of me, who is probably about 70 years old, says, now I'm never getting a COVID shot for the rest of my life. I mean, she was very emphatic about that. Jeff Smith, great to see you. Thank you for coming
Mark,
in.
Just super quick, on 9/11, everyone should read a piece from 20 plus years ago in The New Yorker. It's called The Real Heroes Are Dead, about a Vietnam veteran turned Wall Street security chief named Rick Rescorla. It's a great story about what happened that day. It's a great love story, and it'll get you.
Give me a link to that, and I will put that
on
the Twitter
for sure.
I'm very interested. There's a lot of these great stories that I've seen in the last couple of days. John, great to see you. We'll talk soon.
Get more at 971talk.com.